Hello there, and welcome into another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. First up, some encouragement in maximizing the Christmas season from Heather Patterson, who writes a blog along with her sister. Together, they have crafted a book of ideas to celebrate a variety of seasons. Recently, she shared with me some insight into the celebration of Christmas. Then it's fiction author Terry Reed, who's written a novel set in the Christmas season about two people brought together during the holidays. Plus, it's Tim Witter of the Parents Television Council, who offers some insight regarding inappropriate language being used by teenagers on primetime broadcast television. And on this edition of The Intersection, some projections from J.C. Derrick of World Magazine about actions taken by the Obama administration that could be undone or altered under the new Trump administration. Finally, Justin Butterfield of First Liberty Institute with comments about a recent court victory regarding our national motto and its presence on American currency. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. Heather Patterson and her sister Vanessa Hunt write the At the Picket Fence blog and have co-written a new book called Life in Season, Celebrate the Moments That Fill Your Heart and Home. Heather talked with me recently and shared comments about the integration of faith into their writings, as well as some ideas for meaningful celebrations of the Christmas season. This is Heather Patterson.
We grew up as pastor's daughters, grew up in the church, and just our faith is the most important thing to us. Everything else flows from that. So for us, our faith has to overlie and overshadow everything that we talk about, we write about. So whether it's a DIY project or a craft or a recipe or just sharing about our life, we're going to weave our faith into that, and you're going to find that in everything we write about. So it's such an important part of who we are that to leave it out was just not an option.
So tell us a bit about this book. It's called Life in Season. Share with me how it's laid out and some of the types of content that you have in the book.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because obviously you have your seasons that we experience in nature, but then also we have the seasons in life. And so what we really wanted this book to be was a reflection of both. So we write to women mainly and mothers and the things that they're experiencing as they go through life. Vanessa has young children soon. I'm moving into the empty nester season of life and what that brings. And so what we really wanted to do was speak to women about the seasons of life that they go through. There's going to be those summer times where it's fun and lighthearted and things seem to be going perfectly in life. And then there's the winter seasons. You know, we're really struggling and we kind of wonder, okay, God, where are you taking us? I feel stuck or I feel dark. And so what we wanted to do was be just very real and authentic and reflect the seasons of life that we go to, but then also realize that, you know, that there's seasons in nature that we celebrate too, autumn and spring and summer and winter. And so the book has both. They talk about, we talk about in the essays, the seasons that we experience as personally, and then also the seasons we experience as a family. So what you're going to find is a lot of narrative essays, just talking about life and very real and raw, but then we're also going to share with you projects and crafts and recipes that you can do seasonally with your family and just those things that really are milestones, you know, throughout the year. So really it covers both. For years, we have loved decorating our homes and kind of going all out for Christmas. And then I think like everybody else, we hit this place where we realized that it was becoming stressful. And we, as bloggers, we put beautiful content on the blog and inspire and encourage and give these great ideas. But then we had this check of like, are we making women feel stressed? Or are we making them feel contentment for their home and the simplicity that can also be Christmas? So we try to strike a balance now in our lives of having beautiful homes and having them decked out for the holidays, but also realizing we don't want it to be a stressful season for women and moms. It's already so stressful, I think, with so many women working and trying to shuffle their kids around and get hot meals on the table. And so what we wanted to speak to was that you can have a beautiful home that welcomes people in and that's warm and inviting, but it doesn't have to be stressful. We don't want women to stress. So in the book, we talk a lot about just those simple things that you can do with your family, whether it's creating your own advent calendar, whether it's creating simple ornaments that you can do with your children so they can participate in the decorating, simple recipes that are warm and inviting and feel like the holiday, but also don't stress you out. And so what we really wanted women to do is say, you know, to them, don't be stressed. be in the moment. Remember what this holiday is about. Remember what Christmas is about. It's celebrating the birth of Christ. It's celebrating your family and this time to be together. And that is more important than your home looking like a magazine. So we hope that that's what people come out of after reading the winter section of our book.
How can someone really maintain that sense of simplicity when the trajectory of the season seems to be something, well, completely different?
Yeah. You know, and that's what we experienced. We've had moments where we've almost been in tears saying, okay, how do I get my home to look, like I said, like a magazine or this beautiful inspiration for other people? And what we realized is what really inspires other people is to be real and authentic. So we've backed way off and talked about just having being simplify. You know, Christmas cards are great. If it stresses you out to send them out, maybe not do them this year. Don't add to the stress. Don't add to the pressure that you're feeling. Simplicity. So our ornaments in the book, we have some ornaments in there. They are meant to be done with your children. And we want you to have fun doing them. It doesn't have to be perfect to be beautiful and warm. And so what we just say is, you know, it's okay if you need to get a takeout one night, or it's okay if the meal isn't always perfect with, you know, the whole place settings and everything. Because you know what? Time goes by so fast, and we really want people to be in the moment. And that's something we had to tell ourselves. And then we hope then we reflect to the women who are reading our book is just be in the moment and enjoy this time with your family. That is the priority.
Heather Patterson here on The Intersection. Find out more by going to the website at thepicketfence.com. The Intersection continues now with fiction author Terry Reed. She's written a novel called A Family Under the Christmas Tree, set in the Christmas season. It features two people being brought together during the holidays. From a recent conversation, this is Terry Reed.
I saw a meme on Pinterest of a dog, a Burmese mountain dog, sitting next to a toppled Christmas tree. And the caption read, "Mom, the tree fainted." And I thought, oh, that is so cute. I want to do a story with a dog. And I want that scene in my book. So I started playing with some ideas and came up with this scenario of a grandma who had this dog that was just a little bit more than she bargained for. And then I thought, well, she needs some help. And so I had her niece, her granddaughter come. And then, of course, she had to have a romance, so the boy next door just seemed like the best choice.
You have granddaughter and the boy next door getting together. Tell me a little bit about their relationship.
Well, the granddaughter, her name is Sophie. She is a photographer, travels the world, and she gets a call from Grandma that she's asking her to come and help her over the Christmas holiday, and it works out that Sophie can do it, and so she comes. Sophie is the youngest of four, or three. She has three brothers, so she's the youngest of four. And she decides, you know, this would be a great resting time before she goes on to her next adventure. David, who is the hero of the romance, lives next door. He with his nephew, and they've just recently moved in and have made friends with Grandma. But David has his own business, and he's trying to balance work and caring for his nephew who is orphaned, and he's gotten custody of him, and he's trying to figure out how to be parent and entrepreneur. And the last thing he needs is the complication of a romance with the girl next door. So sparks kind of fly as they meet, and they're kind of thrown together with Grandma kind of pushing and the dog helping and little Troy bonding with Sophie and Grandma. So it was a fun story to write.
Well, you mentioned David and his nephew. David recently acquiring custody of the nephew. What sort of challenges did that present for him?
Well, one, he had no skill set to be a parent. He hadn't really thought that far ahead in his life yet, so he didn't really know what he was doing. He was a single guy, lived in a studio apartment in a high rise, so he bought a house and tried to set up, you know, this whole life for his nephew, but he's struggling because he doesn't know how to be a parent and doesn't know, you know, how to discipline or you know, what the balance is and how to love this child. He loves this child, but he doesn't know how to love this child. Does that make sense? And so it was really fun to have Sophie kind of help him learn to let his heart open to this child and show love and yet be a parent. Mm. Does that make sense?
Sure. Elaborate on the faith element or elements that you integrated into this novel.
I wanted to really portray how David and Sophie both had this expectation of what their life was supposed to be and how it was supposed to go. And to also really show that sometimes we have to take a leap of faith and just trust that God's going to catch us. And that our expectations sometimes aren't what's best for us. But if we let go of those expectations, we can be blessed in ways we never even imagined.
Terry Reed here on The Intersection. You can learn more through her website. It's Terry, T-E-R-R-I, Reed, R-E-E-D.com. The Intersection continues now with Tim Witter. He is the president of the Parents Television Council. In a recent conversation, he discussed a trend in primetime broadcast TV in which teenagers use inappropriate language. In the conversation, he commented on the implications of this behavior being modeled. Here now from that conversation is Tim Witter.
I think most parents in America believe, they certainly understand, that today's entertainment media environment is toxic for most children and families. There's more graphic sex, violence, profanity, disrespect for authority, drug use, sexualization of girls and women, you name it, coming from almost every channel and almost every time of the day. I don't think it's a surprise that that you see on television some trash talking. What I think is especially surprising from the results of our study is that it isn't just the adults who are using the vulgar and sexually charged dialogue. We now have, and this is not just as you kind of open in your question there, this isn't cable television. This is over the air, primetime broadcast television. You know, the major TV networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, that come into over using our public airwaves. And it's not just the adults that are swearing and using this language. It is now children themselves who are using sexually explicit language, a lot of harsh profanity. Some of that profanity is partially bleeped out, where you might hear the first letter and the last letter, but maybe a little bleep in between. But it barely just, you know, disguises the word that's being used. And this is coming on at all times of the day during prime time, you know, even during the family hour. And it's even on television shows that are marketed as family-friendly sitcoms. So you have children using explicit language. You have shows that are airing at times when children are likely to be watching. Children see characters on TV, the children characters on TV, as peers, as examples that maybe their family doesn't allow such and such a behavior, but when you look and see the other children on TV, you think, well, that's how the rest of the world behaves. So there's just all manner of disturbing direction now coming from the data we've uncovered.
TV content rating system leaves quite a bit to be desired, doesn't it?
It sure does. And when you look at, for example, this show that you mentioned, The Real O'Neills, this is a show that airs on the Disney-owned ABC television network. I would think poor Walt would be spinning in his grave if he realized the type of content that was airing on the network that his company, with his name on it, it owns and programs. This show, The Real O'Neills, actually had the largest number of instances of profanity and sexualized language by teens and children. Literally once every 3 minutes, a child actor is using words that I wouldn't even use, you know, synonyms for to your listeners. These are very explicit words, very sexually explicit. Words that I don't think Walt Disney himself would ever use, let alone child characters airing on his network. And it's happening every 3 minutes. So if you think about this as a parent, you know, you can't be with your child every moment of every day. So you would rely then on the rating of a television show as being family friendly. You would say, okay, my child can go see a PG movie. Well, this is a television show rated PG, and yet the profanity, the explicit dialogue, the sexual dialogue, the sexual situations that are involved in the show with the child characters. Is, you know, I don't even know what to say. It's beyond troubling. It's something that if we don't nip this in the bud, it's going to, of course, grow even worse.
So what did you generally find that a program, apparently Real O'Neill's is one of the lead offenders here. What have you generally found to be the rating for that?
It is generally rated TV PG, meaning it is appropriate for children of almost all ages, perhaps not the youngest of age, but is appropriate for children to view. And so we think that the network is basically defrauding parents. They are posting something that's toxic, and they're posting it as being safe. If you could imagine going to a supermarket and buying a box of food and look at the back of the box and see what the ingredients are, you rely on that. You rely on the wholesomeness of what your children are going to ingest with that food. So, too, are they ingesting this content. Instead of their stomachs, it's going to their minds. And the content is every bit as toxic.
Tim Winter here on The Intersection. Find out more about the council by going to parentstv.org. This is the Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. The website address is meetinghouseonline.info. There you'll find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests here on the Intersection Podcast. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs can be accessed also. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. J.C. Derrick is Washington Bureau Chief for World Magazine and World News Group. In a recent conversation, he discussed some of the prospective actions that could be taken during a new Trump administration that could reverse action, including executive action taken during the Obama administration. Here's J.C. Derrick. So now when you have a pro-life HHS secretary, i.e. Congressman Tom Price, what effect will his appointment have on the, as you call it, the abortion pill mandate?
The administration did craft a religious exemption for that part of the law, but it didn't cover many, you know, Little Sisters of the Poor and for-profit companies like Hobby Lobby that are owned by very religious people. You know, it didn't cover some of those areas, religious schools, even, you know, universities and colleges. So it didn't cover many of the exemptions. The exemption didn't cover many of the people who wanted it. And so that's why we've seen the literally dozens of lawsuits that have come about from that. So essentially, immediately what the president can do, or his administration, HHS, can immediately loosen that exemption to include, you know, essentially anyone who wants to claim it on religious grounds. As you said, in the long term, you know, to really repeal Obamacare, it would take congressional action. And they're saying that, just as an FYI, that will likely be done early in the administration to the extent they can. Full 100% repeal would take, essentially 60 votes in the Senate, which Democrats would probably not go along with, almost for sure. So they will probably use reconciliation, the budget maneuvering that members of the House and Senate can use to pass something that, if it deals with budget matters, they can pass it with only simple majorities in both chambers. So they can undo much of Obamacare using reconciliation. However, undoing much of Obamacare, they may do with sort of a delayed reaction, you know, pass it immediately, but it may not, much like the law itself when it was passed, it wouldn't take effect for 2 or 3 years, so that Republicans can then pass their own replacement before 20 million people lose their insurance.
Another issue I wanted to cover with you, and you mentioned this in this piece at worldmag.com, and that has to do with LGBT issues. Now, pragmatically speaking, we as evangelical Christians who believe that homosexuality is contrary to biblical teaching, that it is a sin, that marriage is between one man and one woman. You've got President Trump, who we really can't depend on as far as these so-called LGBT issues. He goes on 60 Minutes and says that, well, Obergefell is settled. Basically, it's settled, and I'm fine with that. But you do have, in the campaign, where he has promised to uphold religious liberty. And of course, there have been some things said. I will say, and this is something you brought up, when you have Jeff Sessions as the nominee for the Attorney General over the Department of Justice, you have Betsy DeVos as the nominee for the Department of Education, you have this letter that went out to school districts basically saying that transgender students should be allowed to use whatever restroom facility they wish. It seems like with those two individuals in charge of those respective departments, that letter gets ripped up, symbolically speaking.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great point. The Department of Education has been one of those areas that's kind of flown under the radar, but it has had, as most agencies have under Obama, vastly expanded its power. And the one you're referring to is, the Education Department unilaterally reinterpreted the word sex in Title IX, a non-discrimination law that's some 40 plus years old. They reinterpreted that one word to include gender identity. So it didn't require, not only did it not require a vote in Congress, this huge change in policy was implemented without even a formal rules-making process, which allows for public comment and so on. So there was a big pushback. A number of states sued, saying, you can't force this on our schools. And that will be something that almost assuredly will be reversed. But as you noted, there is a variety. We could spend a whole program talking about all the different executive actions and policies that President Obama implemented during his administration. And some of those obviously are a natural result of the Supreme Court's decision last year to legalize same-sex marriage. So, for the purposes of being able to file joint tax returns, and, there's so many things that I'm sure will not be changed. But something like that Education Department letter, which was actually a letter between the Justice Department and the Education Department. It was a co-written letter that basically kind of threatened to say, you could lose your public funding if you don't do this, which is a huge blackmail, essentially. That will almost assuredly be undone. But on many other issues, it does remain unclear how Trump will approach the issues.
J.C. Derrick here on The Intersection. The World website is worldmag.com. Finally, on this edition of the Intersection podcast, it's Justin Butterfield, senior counsel for First Liberty Institute. He discussed a case in which First Liberty filed a friend of the court brief for the American Legion, in which plaintiffs attempted to have the national motto, "In God We Trust," removed from U.S. currency. A federal court ruled against the plaintiffs in the case. Here now is Justin Butterfield.
There have been lawsuits challenging the national motto, "In God We Trust," over and over and over again since the 1970s. So for decades, courts at every level have said the national motto is perfectly acceptable. It does not violate the First Amendment. And it's a perfectly reasonable thing for us to have on our currency. So it's been challenged repeatedly. It's been upheld. And again, in this case, Michael Newdow, representing several atheists and also one person of faith, filed a lawsuit challenging the placement of "In God We Trust" on our currency. And they also attacked the American Legion for supporting that. And so First Liberty Institute, representing the American Legion, filed a friend of the court brief, as you mentioned, defending that and pointing out that, "In God We Trust" as our national motto actually drives all the way back to Francis Scott Key's poem that became the Star Spangled Banner. And many people don't realize the Star Spangled Banner actually has four verses. And in the fourth verse, one of the lines says, "And this be our motto, in God is our trust." And so it really honors the courage and valor of our service members who defended Fort McHenry during the War of 1812. So they filed this lawsuit, again, challenging the placement of "In God We Trust" on currency. And we said that, this is the exact same litigation that you have tried over and over and over again for decades. And really, this was just a waste of the court's time to have to again deal with these lawsuits challenging the placement of the national motto on our currency. And Thankfully, the court agreed and dismissed their lawsuit. It was unfortunate that we had to go through the entire process and had to again stand up for the placement of In God We Trust on our currency, but it happened. And, you know, unfortunately, at First Liberty Institute, we represent a wide variety of clients across the country in religious liberty issues, and we see that in a lot of fields, actually, where we'll see people who just don't learn, and they have the same sort of attacks on religious liberty over and over and over again. We see school districts over and over and over again telling students that they can't share their faith, even though that's wrong. We see states who are confused in the same way over and over and over again, and government officials. And so it's something that, unfortunately, we've had to learn that once you get a court to rule in your favor, that's not necessarily the end of it. You have to keep educating people, keep defending people's rights, because these same attacks come over and over again.
Well, you were standing with the American Legion. You filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of that organization, which, by the way, the American Legion is the largest veteran service organization in America, over 2 million members. I think it's interesting. The name of the case is New Doe Child Number 1 versus the Congress of the United States. You mentioned that Michael Newdow, of course, he is the atheist who has challenged the use of the phrase under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. He's been doing this sort of activity for a number of years now. The defendant, if you will, is the Congress of the United States. So that's how the case gets its name. So how was that defended, if you will, in federal court?
That's right. So the government was the primary defendant, and then we filed the friend of the court brief on behalf of the American Legion, which was important since in the plaintiff's brief, they had actually attacked the American Legion just for historically supporting our national motto. And they were seeking, the reason they sued Congress is they were seeking to have In God We Trust removed from all currency. They were actually wanting to strike down the complete governmental program that includes our motto on our currency. So a rather extreme attack. They relied on a case that came out of New Hampshire saying that the government couldn't prosecute people for covering up Live Free or Die on their license plates if they didn't want to espouse that message. But, you know, in that case, the plaintiff wasn't trying to get New Jersey to stop putting Live Free or Die on license plates. They just wanted to not be persecuted if they covered it up. Well, here, if you are a hardcore atheist and you sincerely believe that you can't even give money away that has In God We Trust on it, there's no law that prohibits you from putting a piece of tape over that or something. But they, instead of just wanting to have that freedom, they wanted to remove it completely from our entire nation's currency.
Justin Butterfield here on The Intersection. The First Liberty website is first, spell it out, firstliberty.org. Well, that just about wraps up this edition of The Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Through that site, you will find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand. Also, you can subscribe to the Intersection Podcast and have it delivered on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. One is The Three, with three stories of relevance to the Christian community. The other is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House program. And you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Intersection Podcast. I'm Bob Crittenden.